Hello, and welcome back to the Talks with the Feminine podcast. I'm Annie Taylor, and thanks for coming back and joining me for this relaunch of the podcast if you're a seasoned listener, or thank you for seeking us out and joining us today if you're a new listener. I'm doing a relaunch of this podcast because, I mean, for a multitude of reasons, but one of the primary reasons is that I really want to open up the wide world of storytelling as sort of a more profound mission of this podcast. I think that the more stories we hear from women, from people who identify as women in whatever capacity, the better off we'll all be. And my guest today actually describes story as medicine at one point, and I think that in and of itself is a really beautiful and accurate way of describing the thrust of this podcast moving forward, in the sense that I hope that by sharing different women's stories, the women and whomever is listening can really gain something that in the form of medicine from this podcast and the stories that are being told. But moving on, today my guest is Rachel Flack. She's a social worker and a postpartum doula. And I'm very lucky to have her on the podcast today, as she's such an honest, open storyteller to have on. You may know her on Instagram or Facebook by the handle A Mama Is Born. And if you want to seek her out after you've listened to this episode, you might like to find her at amamaisborn.com.au. Today, Rachel shares her own personal fertility journey, including pregnancy losses and IVF. She was very, very open and honest in sharing how that unfolded for her and her journey into motherhood. She also speaks a little bit about what it was like being a mum to three children under 3.5. Those children are a little bit older now, but it's still quite a journey to go on. And she shares a little bit about the work that she now does and moving away from her more sort of traditional social work background, now moving into supporting women in their postpartum planning and journey. And she talks a little about the support that women really need in that period of time. So I really recommend listening through to the end. Rachel's got a really interesting story to tell with a lot of really involved challenges. And I mean, just listening to her, I sort of thought, what a powerhouse this woman has become just from what she's experienced over the last few years. So take a listen, and thanks again for joining us. Okay, hi Rachel, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for finally coming on. We finally managed to get the relaunch thing off the
We
ground.
did. We finally got there.
Yes, we did. After so many weeks of my children deciding to, I don't even want to repeat my little Instagram story of projectile vomiting in the car, but other than that,
Oh, and I'm sure my kids were sick at one point as well when we were trying to do it. Something was happening.
yeah, that's true. And you know what? It's just busy lives. That's the
It
trouble.
is. It is.
Yes,
It's mum
and
life, isn't it?
motherhood. That's what I was going to say. We're stuck with
Yeah.
it. So look, I'm gonna dive straight in because I've sort of rejigged the podcast a little bit now that I'm starting back again after having a baby. So I suppose my interests are in telling a bit of stories because I really think women benefit from hearing each other's stories. So that's where I'm sort of going with this sort of thing. Yeah. So yeah. I'm going to start like way back. And I mean, you, just a minute ago, we were talking about how you were, you're from Warragul area. Is that right?
Sort of. So always been in Victoria, but sort of born in southeast, like Dandenong way. And then our parents, when my brother was born, so when I was about three, we moved to Pakenham, which at that point was very sort of country, like pretty much country.
I was going to say, it was in the sticks.
Yes, it was in the sticks. There was no, you know, freeways. There was, you know, all of that. But it very quickly, I guess, grew to the bustling hub that it is now. We grew up there until I was nearly 16, so a really long time, during my primary school years there. We were actually, so my mum's a nurse. Yeah, her background is, and my dad was the stay-at-home dad. He was an amputee, so he was home, and mum did the breadwinning, and so he was the one that did our lunches and took us to school and all that sort of stuff. So we were there for until I was nearly year 10, I guess it was, and then my parents, they were over how busy it got. They didn't love the super busyness of it, so they wanted to move further out, and then they found a place in Warragul with a bit of property, and they moved up there in 2000. In the end, I was only in Warragul for probably 4 years, because by second, third year uni, I was like living down Melbourne. So, and just then moved every year studying, and then moved in with my partner, Matt. And then I finished uni, and then we went overseas.
Yep. All the good stuff. Yeah.
All the fun stuff, worked over there, and then I've moved around again, and then now I'm Bayside. So been in Bayside the last 10 years.
How'd you find moving when you were, you know, because, I mean, moving in year 10 is a big...
I was not impressed. Let's just say that. There was a bit of, for a little while, they gave me the choice whether I wanted to stay at the school that I was in at Beaconsfield or move school straight away, and I decided to stay. And there was a few, you know, jumping off the V line and wagging for the day for a little bit there. but yes, the very early starts got to me fairly quickly. So I think I only did that for a term or two, and then I moved schools and made the decision to move. So, but it was really big. Like, I wouldn't ever want to have to do that to a 15, 16-year-old.
No. I was going to say the moving thing's always a challenge, but in the really formative, you know, this is out when you have your friends or your whole life kind of
age group. Oof. And look, I ended up developing very good friendships, but of course I didn't know that at the time. Like, I just thought this is the worst thing ever.
Of course.
Parents are moving me away from all my friends. But now I'm still friends with, you know, a lot of those people from that school. But it was very hard at the time, but it worked out, thankfully.
It was okay. So do you think you kind of, I mean, having a stay-at-home dad and having a nurse for a mum, and also how all of that sort of played out when you grew up, do you think that kind of influenced your experiences later for where you sort of went professionally and things like that? Or
I think so, definitely. Like, a lot of family members are sort of in the caring professions. Like, we've had a few ambulance drivers, nurses, teachers, those sort of roles in our extended family. I think Mum said, I always had said, even when I was in kinder, I wanted to be, like, I always wanted to work with children or be a teacher or, you know, something like that. So I think I knew quite early on that's the sort of path I was heading towards. And I think, I just grew up in going into aged care facilities and things like that with Mum, and visiting and seeing the nurses do what they do. And so the medical setting didn't really ever faze me. I was really interested by it. Mm. So, it doesn't surprise me that I headed down that path. I think I sort of thought I'd be doing more direct work with kids, which I did a bit in my placements and stuff with social work in sort of foster care and adoption, and I did some adoption work in the UK, but then sort of drifted more to the medical stuff when we got back.
Yeah.
And then, I think I realize how restrictive that sort of environment is as well, though, with what you are able to do.
Yeah.
So I knew I wanted more flexibility.
Yeah. So what was the pull to social work in the first place? So did you sort of...
Yeah, I did my undergrad psych first, like Bachelor of Arts majoring in psychology first, because at first I thought I'd go and be a psychologist. But I think towards the end of that, I sort of realised there was still a lot of study ahead of me without even sort of any practical experience.
Mm.
And then I didn't actually, to be honest, really know about social work until I spoke to one of my best friend's mums later into uni, and she was a social worker and one of the teachers at one of the big unis. And I sort of just gravitated towards that hands-on working with people in different environments, like sort of psychologists a lot of the time are sort of office-based one-to-one counselling, whereas I liked the idea of social work of being able to do a bit of everything, like linking people with resources or, you know, going out and seeing them in their own environment. So I think that sort of got me towards heading down the social work path, I guess, the flexibility around it and all the sort of different fields you can, like social work can work in so many different fields. So I just liked that environment and the flexibility, I think.
Where did you sort of, so you sort of went, well, I mean, you said you worked overseas and worked in adoption and things like that, but did you sort of, I know you sort of have moved around, but you worked largely in the hospital system. What sort of things were you really drawn to, and what did you, I mean, what did you really gain from that, I suppose?
Yeah, I think... most of my time when I was at the large hospital was I was working with adults, but it was all, a lot of it was brain stuff. So it was like neurology, neurosurgery and stroke. I guess that sort of brought back in my psych stuff a bit, like brain development and brain function and how that, if someone's had a stroke, how does that impair them? And then how does that affect their family and what supports need to be put in place? So I really liked pulling that all together, and there's quite a large allied health team in that unit as well, so I really liked working with all the other practitioners and the nurses and doctors and all of that, just to get people where they need to be going, I guess, ideally. It also had elements of sometimes like the palliative care as well, so I actually quite liked that. It sounds a bit morbid, but I liked that side of it, the grief and loss stuff. I did actually do a year over at the palliative care unit there as well. I think I just, a lot of it was bringing in all my training, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, I feel like you, if you're feeling a pull towards the life transition stuff, it's not all that surprising that you wanted to work in palliative care
exactly.
All that sort of thing.
And that's like, I loved the adoption stuff as well, because it was about, you know, people wanting to become parents and sort of all similar undertones, I guess, but we actually don't have a huge, obviously, adoption network or availability here in Australia, so it would be near impossible to, you know, get work in it. But it's quite different in the UK. There's a lot of each sort of council, like, you know, your local Melbourne City Council, like they have an adoption team in each council, like it's very different to how it is done here. So it's just pretty much privatized here, from my understanding. So
yes. I don't know. I've spoken to friends who have interests in fostering and adopting and things like that, and it sounds like it's near impossible unless you have a citizenship somewhere else. So that would have been a pretty huge opportunity to work in that, since
It was good. I was a very new social worker at that point, and we sort of, it was going to be time limited because we weren't living in the UK forever, but great exposure and great learnings and teachings while I was over there. Great team, so,
enjoying your life as well, because
young
and doing whatever you like.
Pre-married, carefree life. Yes, we're just working to earn money to travel and eat. Yeah.
Yes, those are all the best things at that age, I feel.
I know, absolutely.
So were you with your partner at that point? You were in the UK?
Yeah. So we had met a few years before that, living together for a few years before we went overseas. I hadn't, probably overseas travel hadn't quite been on my radar, I think, because I was just in the study mode. Like, he's a couple of years older than me, so it was always on his cards to do that. And yeah, as soon as I finished, we went, I worked for 6 months and then we went over. So I was only had been out of uni 6 months when we went over there. So it was awesome.
Fair enough. Yeah. And so I guess that's a good point to sort of start talking about how you work, how you came to your motherhood journey, I suppose, like since that's when you were partnered up. Where did you go?
So we got back from overseas engaged, and then we took the year to organise a wedding, and we got married in the end of 2010 down at the beach. And then we just assumed we would just go and have a baby.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah, because that's what happens, isn't it? When you know, especially when you're 26 and have no known issues, you sort of just think you'll come off the pill and have a baby, basically. That was not the case for us. I came off the pill, which I'd been on for probably nearly 10 years straight.
Yeah.
I had never had like a break from it. I'd never had been told to have a break from it or to, you know, I went on it because of heavy periods, heavy painful periods.
Yeah.
And like skin issues when I went on it. I had to, you know, fiddle around with which one I was on because I broke out in a lot of acne. That was it. Like, there was no other option. Looking into why.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just did it. And then that first year of trying, just my cycles got longer and longer. My skin just absolutely broke out. I put on about 8 kilos in that year, even though I was probably I was doing like about 3 or so dance classes a week, like, and working full time. There's definitely a few indicators there, like, this, you know, what's going on. So, you know, you have to wait that year before you can start investigating things when you're trying to conceive. So we went to our GP and we realized I wasn't ovulating. So she sent us off to a like obstetrician gynecologist and just started some medication, and that worked. He thought I had polycystic ovarian syndrome, and that worked. And then the second cycle on that, we actually did get pregnant. Again, sort of thought, oh, great, okay, we're pregnant now.
No worries now,
That's been our struggle, was the getting pregnant part, but we're pregnant now, so all good. Didn't even really contemplate the fact that we could lose a pregnancy. And then at about 11 weeks, we had a scan and we had miscarried. We had a missed miscarriage. So sort of totally blew us out of the water, really, because we just wasn't even on our radar that that would happen to us as well. So that hit hard.
How did that impact your relationship, if that's a good question?
I think for me, like, I knew I needed time, so I actually took 4 weeks off work. I think my poor husband did everything he could to support me, but I guess, like, as the partner, you really don't know what to do, I guess, because your body hasn't been through it. So I think it would have been really stressful for him. And we were at an age too, where, like, youngish, I guess. We didn't have any other friends that had been through it. We didn't have any friends that had had fertility issues, let alone had had pregnancy losses either. So neither of us sort of had someone we could go to and who really understood, I guess. So it was definitely tough time, for sure. And then sort of, you know, you sort of have to get back onto it, and because you still want this baby, and then get back into it, and you know, you've just all that added stress then of you know, this can happen now. So we spent that rest of that whole year trying, still on that medication, and didn't get pregnant again. So the obstetrician said, look, I think it's time to move on to my colleague at the IVF place. And so we went there. We did 3 rounds of still no definite sort of what's going on here besides the fact I wasn't ovulating. Like, there was nothing sort of overtly obvious going on. We did 3 rounds of what's called IUI, so essentially just giving me medication to ovulate and then using artificial insemination. That didn't work, and then we went on to IVF. So went down that path. We had some transfers. I think by the sort of second or third transfer, we got pregnant again. Things looked a bit strange, like numbers not doing what they needed to do, but we did end up getting a bit hopeful because we had heartbeats at the 6 and 7 week ultrasound, but then at 9 weeks there was no heartbeat again, so we'd lost another baby.
Gosh.
And then yeah, we had like, I think I did some more investigations after that because our fertility specialist was happy to investigate things even further. Then still couldn't find anything.
Oh, gosh. Of
why it was happening. And that brought us up to like the 2014. So 2010 we got married and we started trying at like the start of 2011, and then yeah, up till 2014 we still weren't pregnant. And then we booked an overseas trip as you do. My husband was going to America for work, and we just said to the doctor, so can we book it, like, you know, right. She's like, it's fine if you get pregnant, it's fine, it's America, like there's good healthcare, blah blah blah. And then we did like another cycle of IVF at the start of 2014 and got pregnant with my savior. So it was, yeah, some of the time we sort of started trying and to the day he arrived, it was nearly 4-year process.
Wow.
To get him. So yeah,
and long time. Now I have so many questions. So but you both were like super keen to have children straight away then, if you know you got married and you pretty much started trying straight away. Yeah. Was that a I mean, I feel like sometimes there's one partner that's sort of more keen than the other, but it sounds like you two were just like right on the same page.
I think so. I think because like we'd done the travel, like the big overseas trip, whereas sometimes I was sort of have noticed now sometimes people are doing it once they get married, they'll go and do a big and no one's traveling at the moment, but before all COVID stuff, like people would go and do the big overseas trip or buy the house, whereas we I guess we spend our money on the travel, so the house thing was never going to happen straight away. So yeah, we're sort of just keen to get on to the next part, I guess. I think I've always known that I desperately wanted to be a mother, so as soon as sort of the things have been done, like the study and the travel and the marriage, I was, yeah, keen to get going.
Yeah.
Straight away.
Do you think that coming from like a kind of caregiving, I guess, focused background, as you sort of said, like, do you think that's what informed your desire to be a mum, or was there, I mean.
Yeah, I think so. I just always, it's just something that was innately inside me, I guess. And I imagine it's not for everyone, but for me, I just always knew that's what I wanted to do in life, was to be a mum. Like, I was the kid, like, we had a babysitter when we were in Pakenham that lived a few doors down. Like, she must have been like a family daycare provider now that I reflect on what she was, but we just knew her as a babysitter. So she'd have kids there every day. And like, I was always hanging out at her house to like be able to hold the babies and help look after the babies and the little kids. And I was the older cousin, so I was like the boss and looking after everyone. So I think that was like just my thing. Like, I just knew I wanted to do that. So
yeah. This is another occasion where you and I have got a few things in common, so I was just like,
but memories.
Memories. Yeah, I was gonna say, you could, I mean, I feel like you can do a whole podcast episode on birth stories, and I occasionally do, but how did you birth with your first go?
Look, I think, I guess for anyone that's had pregnancy after loss, like especially the first trimester, is very anxiety provoking. That's where I found it really hard and going to scans. But I went back to that obstetrician we had with the first miscarriage because I just immediately had a very good relationship with him. And he just got me in at about the 8-9 week mark. And then we just did really regular scans every few weeks just to help really with my anxiety. Just to check that there was still a heartbeat and baby was going well. So he was very in tune to that, I think. I think I felt like as I reached each milestone, it reassured me more and more. So, you know, you get to 24 weeks, you know, that sort of viability. You get to like 28 weeks, you know, there's like an 85% chance that a baby will survive if they're born now. So for me, getting the milestones reached was really helpful. For me, I sort of always felt like the labor part of it was never going to be as painful as like the years that we had just had.
Yeah.
I sort of knew I could get through that, then I'm going to be able to get through a labor, I guess, whatever it throws at me. And that's how, that was sort of nearly a mantra that I had, I guess, going into it. We had a very typical first labor because it was long, you know, sort of a couple, few days at home of stopping and starting, and of course always at night time. So I think I went about 3 days with no sleep. And then we just like, we were rang the hospital like, I can't go another night without sleep. Like, what is going on? So they got me in, and you know, things were like slowly happening. But yeah, they tried to give me some pain relief to see if I could sleep, but I couldn't sleep anyway. And I tried the water towards the end, but I was literally falling asleep between contractions.
Fair enough. Yeah.
I know, it was madness. And then I think in the end, I just couldn't stay awake. I ended up having, I could cope with the pain, but it was, yeah, the staying awake. I was just spent, like physically tired, spent, not so much the pain factor for me. I was breathing fine sort of through the pain. So I ended up with the epidural, and actually it sort of woke me up enough and then relaxed my body enough that in the end it was only an hour or two later that I was fully dilated and could get onto the pushing part. So he in the end did have respiratory distress. So after an hour or so of pushing, I ended up needing like an episiotomy to get him out. But yeah, he came out and he was fine. And like, I feel really okay with, like, there's obviously more bits and pieces still, but I actually feel really okay about my birth because I felt really supported along the way, and I knew what was going on. And even like, some people might see that as like, he had his cord around his neck and then respiratory distress is quite traumatic, but I felt okay about it, I think, because I sort of knew what was happening.
Well, the trauma is not about the stuff that happens. It's about...
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying. It's,
I do.
It's about you, not about the stuff. I don't know. Exactly. I've been at births where they someone comes in to check on a woman whose birth didn't go, I don't know, to plans, probably the wrong, but you know, there were it took a path that wasn't expected, kind of thing. And they're like, are you all right? Are you all right? And she's like, I'm fine, because I was looked after and I got to make the decisions about what was going on. So
exactly.
I feel okay. And they're like, oh, we assumed because it was stuff you hadn't planned for that it would be a huge big deal, but no. So
no, exactly. I think
it's interesting that the attitude can switch like that. But anyway, so that's pretty amazing and gorgeous. But how was your postnatal period then as well with you?
Save, he, with all my babies, actually had quite a lot of trouble breastfeeding. All had difficulties with latch. So for me, I was always a bit worried with the history of the hormonal imbalances and the IVF. That I could have, you know, I sort of thought I'd potentially have issues with milk supply. I actually had quite the opposite. So I was quite abundant supply, but they had poor latch. I hadn't even really thought about that being a factor with poor latch. I didn't guess know enough. I didn't, for me, like many, the reading and the looking into was more about, you know, the labor and each step of the pregnancy, where I was at. I was so focused on that. I didn't give a lot of thought about the after. I just knew that I'd be a mom and I'd be happy, and like, that's what I wanted. So even like, I actually really loved my newborn days with all of them, but they all did have a range of challenges. And for us, we're not living in our hometown, so both lots of our parents are from the country, and a lot of our siblings and obviously our you know, school friends and things like that. So then I guess navigating that time where you can't just have people pop in with a meal or come and hold the baby while you're having a shower or anything like that, there was definitely exhaustion there. And
you sort of said you didn't have a lot of sort of friends around who just had babies and things as well. So
exactly. Like, you don't get linked with your mum's group until like 10 weeks, but then they're in the same craziness that you are anyway. There was no one that, you know, close by really. Like, we had definitely, like with the first, you have the most amount of visitors, but not necessarily there was definitely a few who would come and do the dishes and bring meals, but like a lot of it was like just coming to see the baby.
Yeah.
Type.
The normal thing. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Normal, inverted commas.
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we definitely could have done with just more probably hands-on like stuff. And, you know, and typically like, you know, Matt was 2 weeks full-time off work, but that included like the 3 days, 2 or 3 days probably, or day at hospital because he was born on the weekend. And then he sort of went back part-time for 2 weeks. So like, you know, after 4 weeks fully back at work and yeah, getting onto it. And that stage, I'm still dreading every breastfeed because it was so painful and yeah. trying to go to drop-ins and, you know, all those sorts of things by yourself with a baby that quickly developed a hatred of the car.
Yes. You know,
it's a bit yeah. stressful yeah. at times.
And apparently that's even that is more than most men take, apparently, like yeah. Some really
yeah
really big statistic of men who don't take the dad and partner pay or whatever yeah, it is
yeah and, exactly and he did do that and you yeah. know we had sort of a thing going where like at night time I'd feed, hand the baby over, he'd do all the changes and getting dressed and nappy changes and hand it back, like, but I've heard of like even friends partners who weren't doing that, like there was that sort of mentality that, oh no, he's got to go to work tomorrow,
yeah,
he can't be up doing the changes, like he's got to sleep through all night, like he's got to work. And it's like, well, you've got to keep a baby alive the next day, you know,
yeah, yeah.
You've actually got to have some rest and not yes. fall asleep on the couch with the baby. So yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
It's interesting too because you both were so keen to have children around the same time. I don't know, I'm just speculating here, but I think sometimes when women really want a baby and they kind of feel like they've talked their partner into it and then they feel like, oh, but he still has to work, I got my baby.
Yes, it's possible. Yes, exactly, you possibly know, a bit of that.
Anyway, side notes. But yeah, so then that was your first baby and then there were two fairly quick
surprises,
successive yeah, so how yeah. did it happen? How did this unfold?
So we got to about the 9 month mark and it was sort of, or 8-9 month mark, and I thought I'd probably, like, I was conscious of the fact that I thought we probably need to go down the route of IVF again. I got my period back about the 6 month mark, which was promising. But then I thought, let's just go touch base with the fertility specialist, see what we need to do in the future when we want to get pregnant again. She basically said, you can't be breastfeeding while you're going through treatment, which, you know, I now know you can.
You can.
You can. But so I was like, okay, I was never, ever going to even contemplate weaning before a year. So we just left it at that. But she's like, you know, if it happens, then just give me a call. If it happens, actually give me a call and I'll do all the initial, you know, bloods and scans and keep you under my care for that first 8-9 weeks. And we're like, yeah, okay, great. Literally called her a week later with a positive pregnancy test.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yes, I was pregnant with a 9-month-old, naturally, which was amazing but also full-on, full-on exhausting. He was in some ways my toughest pregnancy because, yeah, like so little time between labor and being pregnant again. And then at about, how old was he? About 15 weeks, I think I was pregnant. And 2 weeks after Xavier's first birthday, my dad died suddenly. Yeah. Like he's been an unwell man over the years, but it was a sudden death. So we had all that to contend with while, you know, being pregnant and with a like just turned 1-year-old who was hideously teething at the time, like awake for hours upon hours, yeah. like, you know, just hideous. So yeah, it was a full-on pregnancy. I'd had a bit of hypertension with Safe, but we avoided sort of medication or being, I was booked in to be induced, but avoid just got in there without being induced. But then yeah, I was on medication from the second trimester with Charlie. It was quite high. And then I did have to get induced at 39.4, so not too bad, but yeah. it was high, like, and he yes. like he sort of was a great obstetrician where he did sort of would sit back and push it. I think I felt like we pushed it as much as we safely could. I never felt pressured to induce at 38 weeks or anything like that. We were very much going off how I was presenting and how high my blood pressure was, really, and fluid and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, he came at 39.4 and a bit quicker, just the day, but he was induced. Yes. Just the day.
Just the second baby.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
But, yeah, definitely quick, like 13 minutes, second, you know, pushing part. So, yeah, much easier process. Which was lovely. But yeah, the, I had then the two under two. So Zave was literally, they're literally 18 months apart. So I had the two under two boys. And I think that transition was bigger than the, like having a first baby. Like,
yeah,
that was intense. And we definitely planned, didn't plan enough. Like Matt was back at work within 2 weeks. So that was the one where, yeah, the first couple of days that was hospital, and then a week and a half later he was back at work. So,
yeah,
I was at home with two kids under two, two babies really, essentially.
What happened to my life? It looks like this now.
Yeah. This is it. Yeah.
Wow.
So, and then less, like I think with often like more and more babies that come along, like the less visitors or popping in you have anyway. So just like.
Where it should sort of be the other way around. Huh.
Exactly.
And then and then you somehow became a mum to three under three. I've read on your Instagram a couple of times.
So very similar story. Like we got to that a bit later this time. We sort of went to the specialist maybe a bit after the year mark, like maybe 13 months or 40 months, and just because we sort of trying, I could see that my cycles were sort of normal. I think pregnancy and birth at least got my cycles and ovulation happening, which was really awesome.
Yeah.
But, yeah, went back to the same specialist and said, oh, look, this is where we do want the third. And then she did do a few tests, I think, or blood tests. And then, but then, like, yeah, 2 weeks later I rang. I said, oh, actually, we're pregnant. So, yeah, really similar story.
Wow.
So Lily was born like a week before Charlie's second birthday. So there was three, and Zave was three and a half. So yeah, three under three and a half.
Yeah. So each time, how did you feel? I mean, were you really relieved? Were you like kind of a bit freaked out?
So relieved. So relieved we didn't have to go down the IVF path. Like just really feel for those that have like perhaps secondary infertility or just know they have to do it every time they want a baby. Like I just can't imagine going through that. Well, you've already got like a baby. Like it was enough to juggle as, you know, just myself and juggling work and things. I definitely planned a lot more for my third with Lily. Yeah. Like I knew I needed it to be better and more supported. So I actually won like it must have been over the Christmas time, like a postpartum planning session with a local counsellor, postpartum doula.
Wow.
Which was awesome. Like it's exactly, I knew it's what I wanted to do, but like then I got to go and sit down with her and do it like she had it all written out. Like I hadn't got to that state. I wouldn't have thought through it as much as like what she had in her document and what we went through. So just put things in place and we're like, you know, I didn't even know this existed. Like you could get a private midwife who's Medicare rebated to, you know, come and see you in your home, because the breastfeeding again was a big thing for me, whereas like that was going to be a cheaper option for me to get a really well-known midwife who was really good with the breastfeeding stuff at a much cheaper rate than trying to, you know, get to drop-ins or get a lactation consultant in that aren't rebated. So, you know, I had that in place. I had more of the meals. I had the first 6 weeks covered with, like the kinder drop off and like Charlie's kinder gym session. So I wasn't having to do that sort of stuff. So yeah, lots of things like that I just had better in place. So even though Lily, she was probably my trickiest newborn, like from 2 weeks, she was just screaming down the house with, she had in layman's terms, like a floppy larynx.
So
she ended up with really bad reflux and had a lot of trouble feeding. Because like it, like her swallowed was a bit delayed, so she was like quite intense. But I actually felt okay because I had a lot of stuff in place. So yeah, like Lily's postpartum was much better supported, yeah. I guess, than their others, I think, overall on reflection.
So do you feel like you sort of, you said birth sort of regulated your cycles and things to make it a bit more straightforward, or however you want to say it, to conceive without the additional support. Do you feel like, I'm just always interested to know, do you feel like that was a strictly physical kind of shift for you, or was there emotional baggage and things that got unpacked each time that might have felt different to you?
Definitely there's some physical stuff going on. I think there's definitely something about your body's gone and birthed and your hormones now know what they need to do. I notice even with each pregnancy, my skin naturally like clears up, like the acne disappears. So lots of things like that happen. Like I'm very, my stuff's very hormonal based, and we've now sort of definitely had polycystic ovarian syndrome confirmed only in the last year, actually, because it was so up in the air.
Yeah.
But she sort of explained it as like, I'm probably very testosterone sensitive. So like, which would explain all the skin stuff. I don't know. Like, I don't know the science behind what it means after you've been through pregnancy and labor and what it can do to your cycles. But for me, it definitely did regulate. I think too, I became through my whole process very in tune with what my signs are throughout my cycles, and could probably pick when I'm ovulating and all those sorts of things now. But yeah, who knows, was there emotional stuff there? Like, I don't know. Eventually, like, I went into the trying to conceive game, absolutely no idea that I'd have any issues. So I didn't go into it knowing there's issues, and then that was already anxiety there. Like, I just went into it going, oh, this will happen. I'm young. Like, you just go and do it and you have, you know, you get pregnant and, you know, so, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I feel like it goes one of two ways. You either expect it's going to happen straight away and it doesn't, or you expect it's going to take a year and a half and it happens straight away. I don't know.
Straight away, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds from the outside like all of it's sort of, I mean, considering how much sort of work and, you know, even with your first birth and the level of exhaustion, and then your second pregnancy and all the sort of really heavy stuff that you had to carry through that, do you feel like you've come out the other side of three babies just like super warrior queen now? Is that like where you've got to? Because it wouldn't surprise me.
I think like you feel like, even though like that trickiest time was the transition with the one to two, you do sort of come away thinking, oh, like you can like do heavy stuff, can't you? Like if you put your mind to it. But I think I already in some ways felt like those most difficult years were those years trying to conceive and juggling all of that and all the losses. So even with all of these like intense mothering that I've done over the last, you know, say four or five years, like it's probably been its most intensive, it still didn't in some ways compare to that time, like being transported back to that time. I sort of thought like the mothering part overall has probably been easier than what it was those years of trying to conceive and going through miscarriages and going to work and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Like I think I even started the work back then about, you know, because I put my own social worker hat on myself when I had the first miscarriage and immediately just like booked myself in to see a psychologist. Yeah. And I just stuck with her until like Xavier was born. So I did a lot of work over those years about, you know, boundaries and putting things in place like that and using the word no and doing things that were right for me at the time. So I think that transferred into then my mothering. I think I just could see with perhaps family members or like the pressure there to, they felt they had to go and do certain things or attend certain events where like if it didn't work for us, like two out of three of our kids were shockers in the car and all our families over an hour away. So it didn't work for us to be going back every single week or even that regularly. Like we needed people to come to us. So I felt okay with putting that boundary in place and saying, look,
not gonna happen.
Really stressful for us to be in the car. you need to come to us, you know, things like that. I think it really helped in some ways set me up for my mothering and what I sort of needed to do to get through, I guess. So
do you feel like it was sort of, even though it was hideous in some ways, also purposeful in kind of getting you from who you used to be to who you sort of
sure
have now?
Yeah, I think,
yeah,
totally. And I think, like, I didn't know, I don't think I at the time obviously could see it, and I didn't want to be in it. But I think as the years go on and I do some more stuff, you know, self-developmental stuff, I definitely can see, like, the more of the universe's purpose, and you know, trying to, where I can, surrender to letting things be. Like, I had to do a lot of that last year in lockdown.
Yeah.
Because I just started the business, and like, my mind was ready to be out there. I'd done my courses. I'm like, okay, I'm ready to let them be home a bit, and I can be out doing a bit and using my brain differently. And then bam, like, as soon as I started something, we're in lockdown and I literally can't go and do that. They're in my care 24/7 now. even though this was supposed to be my year to go and do stuff and fly the nest myself a bit. So there was a lot of lessons last year learning to try to surrender to that, and that this business will happen when it's meant to happen. And it was meant to be a slow start, obviously not that slow, slower start to it.
Wasn't your expectation,
wasn't quite my expectation. But, yeah, still trying to rein myself in, I guess, with, like, things. If you're so, like, with the wanting to become, I so knew that's what I needed and wanted in my life, and same with this business, that it will happen. And you sort of just keep having to chip away with it, and there's lots of paths to keep trying.
Yeah.
The options haven't run out, so you sort of just keep working at it, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. So I suppose, I mean, you shifted, you sort of shifted out of, not out of social work, but in a different, what's the word, scope? Is that the sort of, like, how did that come to be?
I think I knew, especially actually even from Zave as a newborn, I remember something simple like trying to navigate the Centrelink stuff.
Yeah.
And we were having like a lot of trouble. We went to one Centrelink office and it was just hideous and we didn't get anywhere. And then we went to another one. And I just remember reflecting even back then, I just thought, if it's so difficult for me as a social worker to navigate this system, how is every other parent who doesn't have that background? Like, I am good at like navigating resources for patients and myself, but I was having difficulty with it.
Yeah.
Like, I just can't imagine how difficult it is for others. So I sort of, even then, back then, sort of knew that I wanted to be in that sort of realm of work where you're helping other mothers within this system build up their supports, get the support they need. Because I could sit on the computer and find what I needed in regards to, say, breastfeeding help or whatever it is, but it's time consuming and I'm quite good at searches and ringing around and what I need to do, but many others aren't, or they are anxious about doing that. So I sort of thought, there's got to be something in that, I guess. And I sort of thought at one point, oh, do I go down with social work? You can go and do some more sort of CPD or like training where you can then get Medicare rebated and do counseling like a psychologist. I thought, oh, do I go down that path? But then I thought, that's just counselling. But I wanted the scope of doing all the other bits and pieces. So it was really hard to find, like, what it was out there and what the options were. Not really sure which sort of, I think I even looked at, like, lactation consultant. Like, I was just looking at all sorts of random stuff. And then I don't know how I even came across it. Oh, it might have been through our mutual friend, Katie.
Yeah,
I think I'd seen one of my social workers had liked her sort of Facebook, and then I went into her Facebook and I'm like, oh, she's a social worker who is now doing this thing called postpartum doula. What is a postpartum doula? And then I sort of went through all the paths and saw the courses and asked her opinion on the course that she'd done. And for a while I had to sit on it because I was like, that actually means then, like, I'm going to be like a sole practitioner. I'm going to be starting a business, which I'd never ever, like, I loved like the work where I was in a big team and could play off and get support from other people. Like, I really thrived in that as well. So I never saw myself not being in that. But then I thought, I want the flexibility as well, like the flexibility with the work that I can do, but also with like the family life balance dynamic, as well. Like being able to do the school pickups still, and you know, have the school holidays and do all that sort of stuff as well. So I just, the more and more I looked into it, I ended up committing. It was a big financial decision for us to do the course because, like, I hadn't been earning money for like 5 years.
Yeah.
So all of it's come out of the family fund, I guess you would call it. Mm. So we sort of went into it, and my husband's laughing in the background. and we just, yeah, I've just gone and done it. And just the more and more I get into it, and the more, like, I'm now sort of just constantly, you know, doing courses and, like, just love learning about this space and this mothering system that we have. And yeah, I just can't imagine not doing it now. So I sort of, I'm still at that point where I really want to throw everything in it and just, like, keep at it full time, but then I've got to rein it back and just remind myself, like, I had always imagined and wanted to be at home with the kids until they started school as well. So I don't I also don't want to wish it away. And, like, we haven't used any daycare until, like, they've gone to kinder. But just this year, like, only the younger two have just started family daycare on a Friday, so I can get some work done, basically.
Yeah.
But it's too hard otherwise.
Yes, it's a bit rough having to try and.
So, yeah, I'm still in my days with them, but then, yeah, I'm enjoying being able to get into it a bit more. So it's a very slow burn still to get it all happening. But, yeah, I can't see me not doing it now.
Yeah. And do you think, I mean, it's pretty clear that motherhood's had a huge impact on how you do life. Do you think it's also, do you have an opinion on like the role that motherhood plays in a broader context and the role that women play in a...
Oh, absolutely. Like, I think COVID's highlighted this.
Yeah.
You know, we, if we didn't have mothers around to take up that mental load of, well, the family and, well, it's hard to say mothers, like that main caring person, whoever that is, to, like, they take on that mental load. We saw it in COVID. Like, the stats are there that mothers left the workforce at higher rates. They were the ones that did the remote learning. They lost the income. So if mothers aren't supported or if mothers aren't well, then it, like, severely impacts the rest of society and how we go, you know, about our day, because they're out of the workforce and unable to do their tasks any longer. And if they're not well, then, you know, who's doing all these other things, like the child rearing and their, you know, education through COVID and all those sorts of things. So I think definitely there's a huge impact there.
Perhaps they're able to take away something about where a bit of important funding might go and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. Like, and I guess the government in some ways here in Victoria, like, there's a tiny, teeny bit of acknowledgement with the fact that the kinders are free this year, for example. Like, that's it. But kinders free this year because I know that mothers left the workforce in such huge numbers last year when they couldn't have kinders and childcare open and lost income and things. But there's still a very long way to go. Yeah. Like, childcare is still through the roof. And that's part of the reason we didn't use childcare as well, because I would have essentially had to have gone back full time to make it worth us sending the kids, because if we'd had at least two, we would have had at least two kids in childcare at any given time, it would have cost us a bomb to have them there. It would have just not been worth it. So
it can go the other way too, where you sort of, there's no going back. If you're going to have childcare, going back full time then decreases how much rebate you're going to get, and then you're not going to, it's not going to be worth it anyway. But I don't know. It's, and I think, you know, for those of us who want to, as you said, be at home with their children until they're a certain age and all that sort of thing, it's sort of that that reduction of option, you know. It would be nice to see a bit more broad support for all of the, like, different options that people want to be able to to look after mothers better, I suppose. But, you know, you're one of the people on the front lines of change, I suppose, now. I don't know if you,
I think that's what it sort of feels like in a way, like, not so much like me personally, but I think the concept of taking care of mothers better and taking care of people that have birthed babies, because we're certainly not improving here in Australia. You know, the rates of depression and anxiety are still at the same level and slowly going up. They're definitely not decreasing. So, you know, why are we not looking at other cultures and how they do it, and, you know, adopting that sort of mentality of that women are given carers and looked after for that first, you know, whatever it is, 40 days or 30 days or 6 weeks, you know, everywhere does it a bit differently. But why is that not funded like other countries? Instead, you know, we see a GP at 6 weeks and get a clearance, and, you know, you see maternal child health, but, like, sadly, it's really more focused on the baby, you know, the weights and how they're going and how's they're sleeping and feeding. There's not a lot, like, in regards to the mother's care. Like, you might do the Edinburgh scale of how you're feeling, but many mums just quickly do that and tick the boxes, and, you know, I think they're stuck in a system too, the nurses. Like, they've got a tick box system that they've got to do. They don't have time to really sit with mothers and, like, really nut out how they're going either, like, in a 15-minute appointment. Like, you can't get very far. So, and mums don't want to have to go out. Like, they want people coming to their, well, I think most of the time in those early days, you want someone to be able to come to your home so you don't have to worry about getting out between feeds or, you know, any of that sort of stuff. All the things, like, so many things. So,
There's
definitely scope for it. And I think it starts, it even starts before the baby comes. Like, that's where some of my work, or my, you know, grand plans with the work, is to be supporting people in, like, the trying to conceive process, because like, you need the support early on, especially, like, once you hit a bump in the road, more so, like, if you are going down, like, a path of IVF or something like that, or multiple miscarriages, like, you need the support then as well, like, because you are, there's so many things you're trying to juggle, and it's really, and again, even more isolating, I think, because you're not talking about it as much, so you're just trying to get on with life. But you actually need the same level of care in a way as a mother does, especially if you're having pregnancy losses. You're still postpartum. You've got all those changes happening. So having someone to come in and care for you, it's just as important.
So. Yeah. And actually, I think we were talking about Katie before. She, on her episode with me, she was talking a bit about the postpartum planning stuff, I think, that, you know, we, you know, you sort of alluded to earlier that, you know, even for yourself, you kind of thought, it's fine, I'll have the baby, and then I'll have the baby, and it'll be fine, and
it'll be fine, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, and it's just interesting, you know, I think that idea of making a plan for what your postpartum will look like.
Absolutely.
And I thought you had some really good ones earlier with, like, you know, having a meal train actually organized and things. I suppose, I think I've posed this question to a few people now, but do you think that this it starts with the asking, getting comfortable with asking? Because I think a lot of us get into this headset, you know, mindset of, well, I don't want to put anyone out. And
absolutely.
So what do you think?
I think we are definitely, we have trouble asking for help. And I think, you know, we don't want to put other people out. And I think because it's the way we live in our four walls in our society here, and we're not, you know, living in a village, we're just seeing people anyway. So you don't know people around you often very well or well enough, or they're in the same season as you. So, like, you know, or your mum's group or your girlfriends, perhaps they're all got young families. So, you know, they're just as busy and as tired as you. And so they're good for the chat, but, like, the practical stuff, they're not as helpful as. So then you're left with, well, do I ask for help? And my family don't live near me either. They're too far away. You don't want to inconvenience them coming an hour's drive. You know, I think it's definitely how we're set up here. It makes it very hard to ask for help because we just don't have our people that we need at the time around us. And there's uncertainty about reaching out to neighbours because we're a lot more transient. You know, we're not living in the same neighbourhoods for 60 years like we were a long time ago. People move around a lot more. There's a lot more people renting. So, yeah, you don't know your neighbours as well either. So, like, who do you call on? And most people don't have the funds to, you know, hire a nanny or a mother's helper or, you know, even a doula, like I'm very well aware that not everyone can afford my services either. But I guess that's where if you know your family and that can't be there at a drop of a hat or doing all that, practical stuff, then you're looking at, okay, perhaps that's what we need instead of the fancy cot sheets or the toys or whatever it is, like actually people putting in money for us to get that support that we need in those first few weeks if we can't get it from our family and friends because society isn't able to provide it for us and the government isn't able to provide it for us. So,
But maybe the necessity of it at some point in the future will mean that we are actually, the more people use that sort of service, the more it'll appear as a necessity, I think. So that's...
Oh, we've got to hope so, I guess. And we can model it off of other countries. Other countries are doing it. So
Just
got to wonder what else do we need? Like, the skyrocketing mental health issues here at the moment. Like, what more do you need?
Yes, that's right. So, yeah. Well, look, I will start to wrap up. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us all about your story. As I said at the start, I think we all benefit from, I think women get into this habit of being backed into a little corner, like that they're the only one experiencing what they're experiencing, and that can be really isolating. So thanks for being
totally,
really open about your, really, challenging journey in some ways as well. So
I definitely, I'm a strong believer, I guess. Like, I've always been a talker anyway, but just, I'm in a good place now. Like, I wasn't as open, I guess, about my fertility stuff when we were in it and amongst it, but that was also some, self-preservation in the workforce and all that sort of stuff. But now that we are through it and in a good place, I think, story is medicine. So if, you can share your story, then ultimately, hopefully, others can benefit for it. Like, that's why, when you go into lockdowns and things, I definitely feel it because I miss my people. Like, I need my people around me to share and to talk and, all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. The world's definitely turned a couple of times since lockdowns became a thing. That's for sure.
Sure has.
Well, I will say goodbye, but thanks again. And here's hoping no more lockdowns this month, at least.
At least, sure.
At least. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks again for joining us today on Talks with the Feminine. And if you have a story that you'd like to share on the podcast, or if you have a question for the podcast or for me, you can find me at annietaylor.com and reach out via the contact page. You can also find me on Facebook or Instagram. And for any other information, check out the show notes. Stay safe, and hopefully we will see you again next week.